This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one and only official UK Seahawkers podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, this week is joined, as ever, by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. It's been fun listening to you do five takes of the opening. And all I can say is I'm pleased we finally got there. Maybe we haven't, but I think we should be there now.
Yeah. We'll just ignore that and we'll keep on motoring on. Yes, this week we get to talk about the rarest of rare things over the last 10 months or so, a Seahawks win as they face the Dallas Cowboys at CenturyLink Field. We will also look forward to this weekend's game, the first NFC West divisional game of the 2018 season in the desert in Arizona, as well as a pretty cool interview I did earlier this week with New York Times bestselling author eight times over, Jeff Perlman, talking all about his book, which is on the USFL, United States Football League, which was around in the 1980s. But before that, as I said, the Seahawks won. Joe Buck and Troy Aikman annoyed a lot of people, but here is how the game sounded from the voice of what I think is probably the best play-by-play announcer that covers the NFL in Joe Buck.
Seahawks hurry it up, pass to the end zone for the touchdown, Seattle, and Jerron Brown. Seahawks have converted four straight third downs. Wilson, Lockett, touchdown, Seattle. Second down and 14, this one to the sideline, what a throw and catch. Like Wilson just handed it to Brandon Marshall. Unbelievable.
Five-year quarterback, because this is good coverage by Chidobe Awuzie.
Another high snap, and here's Carson for the touchdown.
So, yeah, the Seahawks come out victorious 24-13, and as Casey and the Sunshine Band once sung, that's the way we like it, Adam.
Blimey, you are in holiday mode, that's for sure. Is that the way we like it? We certainly like the score at the end. Yeah. That was great to see. It was certainly great to see a dominant defensive performance. I mean, they look incredibly well coached. That offense is still not for me particularly. I'm sure we'll get onto it. But yeah, in terms of the win, that is exactly the way we like it. And please God, there'll be plenty more of those this year. Especially with the way the NFC looked, sadly, due to injuries this week.
Yeah, especially the NFC West, which we'll get onto a bit later. But yeah, we'll start for a change on the defensive side. Through three games, they now have seven interceptions. It's the third week out of 3 weeks where a Seahawk defender has finished a game with multiple interceptions. Obviously, McDougal did it in week one, Shaquille Griffin did it on Monday night, and this man did it on Sunday.
Rare throw, pass is broken up, and now they're going to say catch and fumble. Thomas on the return. Gallup had it, lost it. They're calling it a catch, and Seattle takes over inside the 30. Thomas pins it against his leg as to that tackle. Here's one over the middle, in the air, and it is intercepted by Seattle. And Earl Thomas, as he bows to the Dallas sideline.
Yeah, after all which was said and what wasn't said, for more to the point, especially over the weekend, the 48-72 hours leading up to the game, it always kind of had to be Earl Thomas was one of the main talking points coming out of the game. But for a change, it was, for the most part, for what he did on field and his value to this team on field, despite his Allen Iverson-esque attitude to practice, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, it's a completely untenable situation, and I imagine it's... It almost seems unprecedented where a guy's basically said, I'm not really going to practice if I can't be asked, and I'm going to play. Now, there isn't another player in the team, probably outside of Russell Wilson and maybe Bobby Wagner, that would be afforded such luxury. It's insane to be in this situation, and you know, this it won't be a popular thing to say, but he still should be or should have been traded by now, because it's just not possible to go on like this. But if as long as he's here, I'm happy to reap the rewards of two interceptions and a dominant performance, because he was fantastic as always.
So do you still not see a chance that the team give him what he wants?
The main thing they should do is pay him. That is what they should do, and that is everyone's number one preference.
Yeah.
But on the assumption that doesn't in any way seem to be the case, that's going to happen, he shouldn't really be here anymore.
No. Yeah, there needs to be a resolution to it, and there should have been one, as you say, quite a few weeks ago. But yeah, but Earl Thomas got the two interceptions. He bowed to the Cowboys sideline, which has some pretty interesting faces on the Cowboys side. I mean, does that? I mean, that is the ultimate. It's like a power play almost from doing the bowing, is it, or is it a little bit just a bit weird?
It was quite funny, and I think in a way he seemed to be suggesting that it was the Cowboys that disrespected him. When he was talking about the disrespect being noted, I think that's as much what it was about as anything else, because. He obviously isn't happy, or wasn't happy at all. The Cowboys refused to trade for him and extend him. So I think as much as he feels disrespected by the Seahawks, it's as much by the Cowboys. And I think he wanted to make that point very clear on when he had the chance on Sunday.
Yeah. But yeah, obviously also on the defense, they did get to the quarterback Dak Prescott 5 times on Sunday for the loss of 31 yards for the Cowboys. I mean, that O-line has been talked about for, well, what, 3 or 4 years, if not longer, as the blueprint to follow for the other 31 teams in the NFL. But they got through, and they got through. If they didn't get to Dak Prescott, they certainly got him off his spot, which is something that we've wanted to see and not seen, especially when the schedule turns and better quarterbacks are on the opposing sideline, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, that offensive line all of a sudden is shot, which is, you know, great for us on Sunday, but they certainly wouldn't have been like that a couple of years ago.
No.
And fair play, they reaped full rewards. I mean, I think Jaron Reed got through a couple of times. Linebacker sacks are my favourite thing. Like, I just love when you just see a guy fly off. And I think Mingo had an absolute belter that I was just thinking. I didn't even know who 51 was at the time. I was to pull back the curtain. I was forced to watch. Forced. I wanted to. I was watching The Bodyguard at the same time, the grand finale, because I didn't want to have any spoilers. So I had the laptop open on silent and watching that, and I was thinking, who the hell is number 51? And it was Mingo, and I think Kendricks had got through once, which was a pretty cool play. And yet the defense played really well against a terrible offense. Our defense made them look terrible. But I mean, Dak obviously didn't have a particularly good day. Zeke helped us out a couple of times with a couple of stupid things that he did, but fair play. Like, it's a well-coached defense, which is really good to watch.
Yeah, it really is. Obviously, a big part of that on Sunday was the return of Bobby Wagner. And while he probably was nowhere near 100%, it makes a difference just him being on that field in the middle of that defense, even just calling the plays, which is what Austin Kleto did in Chicago. It makes such a palpable difference, which seems silly to say at this point for Bobby Wagner.
Yeah, it's everything. It's almost like the defense, when you put Earl Thomas in the secondary, has a respect that, from the opposition that is not given. You can see that by the different plays that are called against us. And I think almost having Wagner there is the same. People know they have to avoid that area. And even the sideline to sideline speed that he offers you, it just changes everything. And he's probably, you know, for the first time, I think I might say that he's now probably the most important defender we've got.
Yeah, I don't think that's without... Although, I think that's in question at this point. Yet, 7 turnovers through 3 games. This point last season, the team only had 3. I mean, we still had Earl Thomas back there, although we obviously didn't... I think he missed 10 or 15 snaps in week 1 against Denver, but he's still back there. So it's not the case that teams don't have that threat way back on the deep balls. But the absence of Sherman and Cam Chancellor seems to be giving the opposing offenses the idea that throwing on the Seahawks is a good idea, but so far to our benefit, Adam.
Yeah, I think it certainly was to our benefit on Sunday, but then if you look at the scripted plays that Nagy ran against us last week in Chicago, that didn't look too great. And you do worry that a good offense and a good offensive coach is going to have his absolute way with us. That does worry me slightly. But given that, the way they played, you know, if we're in a position that we can beat all of the bad teams around us, mm-hmm. then I'll take that, because I think we'll end up having a better season than hoped. And, you know, maybe you can push to that 7-8 win level that I initially thought was out of reach, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've got three games before the bye week. After the London game, there's a very good chance that the team is going to sit not only at 500, but with what happened in the NFC West elsewhere this week and how the other teams look in the NFC West, especially the one we're heading down to play this weekend, they're going to be well set for being a bit of a spoiler at the very least at the back end of the season, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, if they can get to 3-3 by the time the bye week comes around, you'd probably have to take that, given we were 0-2 and we'll have played four road games by that stage. So that's not the end of that wouldn't be the end of the world by any stretch of the imagination. Whether that can happen, I'm not sure. I have a bit of a feeling that the Raiders might give them fits in London. I don't know why. I've just got a bad feeling that the Raiders might manage to get something to click. But it's a long way away. But yeah, if they can be 3-3, I mean, they do have tricky stuff to come. But you know, if Aaron Rodgers isn't healthy when we play them, that could be an advantage. If we can get the Minnesota from last Sunday, that could be a huge advantage. So maybe we have half a chance. Again, I don't think this team is anything like a playoff team, but they certainly look better, certainly defensively, than I feared they might do initially.
Yeah, the defensively has been easily.
It's been good.
The biggest positive of this season. On the other side of the ball, Russell Wilson, 16-26. Just 129 yards, two touchdowns, but probably most prominent is just the two sacks for 10 yards. I mean, Chris Carson ran the ball 32 times. Rashad Penny just 3-1 fullback dive on a short yardage distance. But those 32 rushes, while they 102 yards. What was the? I mean, the Dallas Cowboys had a better yards per carry, didn't they? But just the 32. Hits on a defender did enough to slow down the pass rush, and everyone, even without Justin Britt, Joey Hunt as a starter at centre, everyone on that O-line, with Fluker in at right guard for the first time this season, Sweezy switching over to left guard in place of Posic, who was out injured, everyone on that O-line looked better, and well, they looked like we hoped they would look the last couple of years, didn't they?
Yeah, what did you make of the running in general? Because people are lauding the fact that, you know, the run was one of the main reasons why we were able to win, and it made a huge difference. And I don't think that it was, you know, obviously it wasn't a bad thing, but, you know, Carson is getting lauded, and, you know, he certainly ran hard, but he was at 3 yards per carry.
Yeah.
So it's not like we were bashing them up in the run game. So I can't really work out what I think about that, because in a way, all of our, you know, good explosive plays came through Russell Wilson, as we all expected them to do.
I literally think the biggest thing of that is the 32 yards, and that it is the 32 carries. Sorry, 32 carries against any defense is going to slow down the pass, which I think if you switch over the five sacks we got on Dak to our side, I think the Seahawks aren't well enough equipped without Doug Baldwin and with the bloke calling the plays to win a game where they give up 31 yards through just sacks. But I think keeping it down to just two sacks, and one of them was, I think, was when he just stepped up. I think he stepped back, he dropped back so far and stepped back up into the pocket where he kind of just got swallowed up, so he can't really put much blame. But I do think the biggest number for it is the 32 rush attempts, because you just after Monday, where they give up on Carson in particular, but just just if they just keep pounding it, it doesn't. Yeah, it.
Do you think that's winning football? Though? Do you think we can win realistically like that?
Not against the teams we're going to start facing the other side of the bye week. Probably, obviously, we've got the Rams in a couple of weeks, but the other side of the bye week is where it really picks up against against Matthew Stafford. That offense can do it all, can do it long. Do the long ball and just slice and dice you as well. But no, I just think on Sunday, the biggest thing was just keeping Carson going. He only had a long of 13 yards, and that was a pretty damn impressive run as well in itself. But I do think just the fact that they kept them honest in the pass race, and they just couldn't pin their ears back, which is what Khalil Mack and Von Miller could do in the first 2 weeks. That little half second, we've said that for a couple of years, about just giving Wilson that extra half a second made all the difference on Sunday against, as we keep saying, not the best team. It's the Dallas Cowboys, but it's not the Cowboys that we've seen the first 15 months of the Dak Prescott in Dallas. If we talk about our weaponry on the outside, apart from Zeke Elliott, that offense is
terrible,
not good at all. Yeah, Wilson again hooked up for the third week to Tyler Lockett on a touchdown throw. The second one, this one was over 50 yards this week to Tyler Lockett. We questioned whether he was worth $10 million, but if he gets a touchdown every week, you can't ask for much more than that, can you? Four catches on six targets, 77 yards and the score. Not bad.
No, and actually I thought you have to check the numbers, but I'm think the other three catches were all chain movers on second or third down. Yeah. And actually that for me was much more significant, sounds ridiculous, than the touchdown, because it wasn't just, you know, like throwing a guy out there and throw him a deep ball and make him catch it. This was a play that actually mattered and helped the team go forward, which is something that we're looking from Lockett to do, you know, be a player that can actually help us move the chains and, you know, basically be a Doug Baldwin-esque player versus being a Jermaine Kearse type player. So if he can do that, that's great.
Yeah, and obviously Jaron Brown finally appeared 3 weeks into the season with his touchdown on a play which looked like one they ran quite often to Sidney Rice a few years ago, Adam.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of the winning touchdown to Jimmy Graham last year against Houston as well. Just that hurry up the middle, just a go route from a big bodied guy, and it was great. And you know, Jaron Brown's not a fantastic player, but again, he's contributing, and if he can keep doing that, then good on him. That's great.
Yeah, and obviously Brandon Marshall didn't have the greatest first half, but that throw and catch over Chidobe Awuzie, which is on the soundbite a few minutes ago, that is as good as it gets. We talked about Russell Wilson trusting his receivers and throwing into tight windows. That's the archetype of that, isn't it? It's just exactly what we're talking about. He needs to do that more often, because obviously Brandon Marshall basically just put his hand out and it was on a silver platter for him, wasn't it?
Yeah, he made some brilliant throws. And I guess this is the whole thing with the running game. Like, I just think, well, Wilson's by far our best player on offense, so put the ball in his hands more and better things will happen. It may not be the way they want to play, but all of the great plays that we produced on Sunday, they came from Russell Wilson. And it does seem a bit strange to have all these rushing attempts to just take the ball out of your best player's hands, and I'm not convinced I'm that pro it.
No, but also with all that said, though, Schottenheimer is still, isn't it?
It just does nothing for me. Like, I know it's ridiculous to be negative about the way they play after a good win, but all the good stuff they do for me came when it was Russell Wilson doing his stuff versus rushing, but I guess we probably need a larger sample size to see how it goes during the rest of the season before I can make any claims like that. But ultimately, it was a great win. They played really well, and they probably played the right horse for the right course on Sunday, which was chew clock, keep running, and just, as I say, wear down that pass rush.
Also on Sunday, they did, with 39 rushes and 16 completions, Adam, they hit 55, which is that random number, beats that random number that Schottenheimer trotted out in the off-season as well. So, I mean, that holds a little bit more weight, even though it's still, frankly, ridiculous. one to praise on either side of the ball. A lot of people will be put on Twitter on late Sunday are giving it to McDougal on the defensive side. Where are you going defensively?
Jaron Reed. I thought he had a really good game, and Elliott had a few big plays, but in general, I thought he was bottled up as well as a great player can be. That had a few long, because obviously one of his long runs, which went for about 40 yards, ended in a fumble. I still think you get the yards for that, don't you?
Yeah. Because he had 127 yards on the day, so the run defense. But I think Jaron Reed is probably one of the more underrated run defenders in the league. If he can chip in with, like he did on Sunday, two sacks, if he can get to half a dozen sacks through the season, then he is a proper player in this defense, which is some, we haven't had. I mean, he come in and replaced Brandon Mebe, and it's took him a couple of years to get the pass rush opportunities. So it's just, again, it's just strange that the pass rush is coming through for Jaron Reed when he hasn't really, on paper, got the name value he had his first couple of years in Seattle with Avril and Bennett, is it?
It's all
a bit weird.
Yeah, he's a very unglamorous player, really. You know, he's a proper down-in-the-trenches kind of guy. He's not the guy that makes, you know, huge showreel plays, and he's probably one of those players that 80% of fan bases haven't even heard of the guy, I would imagine.
No.
But he's great for us, and I'm delighted we have him. A rare, very good draft pick.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick with Jaron Reed as well. Frank Clark also was giving Tyron Smith, who's now, without Joe Thomas, widely regarded as the best left tackle in the league, his speed rush against Smith absolutely destroyed him. So he just get an honorable mention. I do think Jaron Reed should get the nod. Offensively, Adam, one to praise?
Offensively. I think I'm going to go with Lockett, actually. I thought he made two or three really important catches to keep the chains moving when the game was tight. Yeah. And then he did what we needed him to do and break off the really long run for the touchdown. So I'm going to go with Lockett.
Yeah, I think for me, just because of how the O-line stacks up against that D-line, which is we were a bit worried about a week ago, I think Joey Hunt deserves a lot of credit. He stepped in for Justin Britt, who gets... is it overhyped, maybe, Justin Britt? I don't think he's at the level he is, but he's just the best of a bad bunch for the most part in that. But there didn't appear to be a breakdown in like protection or anything. Everything seemed pretty sound up there, and it did send me to over the cap and spot rack over late on Sunday night to see what the damage would be if Joey Hunt can kind of push Justin Britt out of the way, who does appear to be back on Sunday, because he did not miss a beat, and I think he deserves a lot of credit. I mean, he's undersized. I think Jim Nagy posts on Twitter he's undersized, but he is as technically sound at that position as they come, which was clear to see on Sunday. So yeah, it could be an interesting decision down the road for the Seahawks at that spot. But yeah, moving on. This week we were joined by a pretty cool guest. Jeff Perlman is an 8-time New York Times best sellout with a variance of books, but this new one is out, and it's called Football for a Book: The Crazy Rise and Crazy Demise of the USFL. And I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to talk to Jeff earlier in the week about some of the crazy stories in that book, through that in the legend of the league, and some of the people who have come out on the other side and are now NFL Hall of Famers. So here is my chat with Jeff Perlman.
All right, this is Michael Sean Dugard, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast.
Right, this week on the Pedestrian Podcast, it's time to welcome on another esteemed guest. This week we have someone really special who has a CV and a resume like few other people in the industry. Our guest this week is someone with 8 New York Times bestsellers, including The Gunslinger, which was all around Brett Favre, and Sweetness, which focused in on Walter Payton. But the reason he joined the podcast this week is because he's got a new book out profiling, as it says on the cover of the book, The Crazy Rise and the Crazier Demise of the USFL. It's titled, before that, Football for a Book. And our guest on the Pedestrian Podcast this week is Mr. Jeff Perlman. How are we, sir?
I'm good. That was a awesome introduction. Thank you so much.
No worries. We really, as I said before we started, really do appreciate you taking the time. I've seen you on Rich Eisen and Good Morning Football and all the rest of it. And obviously you did Peter King's podcast, I believe, as well.
Yeah.
So I imagine it's a busy time with the book release. When I saw the book was coming out, as I said to you in the messages, the USFL story is something that's fascinating to me. Obviously, watch Small Potatoes. It's one of my favourite of all the 30 for 30s. It's so cool to get that bit of history that I didn't really know about before I'd watched Small Potatoes. But I've got to be honest, I did think this was probably something you just picked up a few years ago. But reading the book, it's something that's been a part of your life for a long, long time. How did this project begin?
I mean, if you want to go to the origins, it began in 1990. I mean, when I was in high school, and my teacher assigned, it was my last year of high school before going to college, and my teacher assigned a 20-page paper on the subject of your choice. And, you know, one student would do the history of Ronald Reagan, and another person would do New York State. And I said, I want to write about the United States Football League. And my teacher, I still remember my teacher, Mr. Height. He was a very good teacher, but he was kind of like, really? That's what you want to do? Really? I was like, I do. And I ended up doing it, but I wrote 40 pages instead of 20. And I've learned now as an adult, there is no way in hell my teacher read the 40-page paper. No way. No way. Because I wouldn't have, so there's no way he did. No. But that was it. That's how passionate I was about it. I always, for years and years, have wanted to write that book. And here it is. You know, I write books, and I've been trying to get a deal for 10 years about a USFL book. Could never get one. And finally, I kind of convinced a publisher to give me one.
So what was it about the USFL that drew you in?
I mean, I think a couple of things. When you're a kid, everything seems big. Everything that's colorful seems a million times more colorful. Everything that's large seems even larger.
Yeah.
A sports hero seems like he's a superhero. You know, your favorite singer seems like he's Elvis. You know, everyone seems giant. And when I was a kid, the USFL seemed giant. It was new colors, new uniforms. They were playing in spring instead of the fall. They were challenging the NFL. Their first big signing was Herschel Walker, who had just won the Heisman Trophy at Georgia. It was like, it just seemed so big. And I love the league. I followed it for 3 years. It vanished, but it always stuck with me. It just always did. I don't even know why. It just always stuck with me. And, you know, again, I became an adult, and I started writing books for a living, and I always wanted to write that book. And I could never get a deal. And finally, I wrote Gunslinger, which you mentioned, the Favre book.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of offers for that book. And I said to Houghton Mifflin, one of the publishers, I said, I will do this book, a Gunslinger, for less if you give me a deal for USFL. And they gave me a very cheap, crappy deal. But they gave me a chance. That's all I wanted. Yeah. I can't complain.
Yeah. So how long did it take to collate all the book? I mean, I've read you've got hundreds of interviews with all the people, some of the people involved at every level. How long did it take to actually put the book from page one to the back page all together?
Well, so because I wasn't making much money for it, I usually take 2 to 3 years for a book. And this book I had a year. But I didn't want to go cheap on it. I didn't want to skimp on it because I really believed in it. So it was just a year of nonstop, hard-nosed, dogged. I interviewed more than 400 people. It was just calling and calling and calling and calling. It started the day I got the book deal. I went online and ordered every media guide from the old USFL. So, you know, I probably spent $200 on USFL media guides. And then it was finding the people and just digging them out. So it was it was a labor of love. It truly was a labor of love.
That's cool. So one name I didn't really, I don't think Small Potatoes really focusing much. It's not a name I was familiar with, but even just reading the first few chapters of the book, it's someone who really should be talked about more. It's David Dixon, who is the man behind it all, got it off the ground. But even him getting off the ground was something which took a few decades, didn't it?
Yeah. So it's, I like that you're asking about him because a lot of people don't. He was a founder of the league. He came up with it. He was from New Orleans, Louisiana, and he came up with the idea in the 60s because he wanted a team for his home city, but the NFL wasn't going to give him one. So he came up with this idea of spring football and we'll have another league. And then the Saints came to New Orleans, and then he didn't need it. But he never fully like let go of the idea. And in the 80s, he kind of brought it back. And he got a lot of wealthy, rich men to go along with him. Yeah. And before long, he had this league up and running. And it wasn't perfect, and it wasn't, you know, had its issues, but it was a real league with real stars, and like you and I both really got a kick out of it, you know.
Yeah. So it, also, he's someone like you with this book, this project, this book. He's someone who had an idea and kind of stuck with it for all that, didn't he? He didn't give up entirely until it got off the ground in the '80s, did he? Which is something which you obviously have maybe gone through with this project.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't really think of it that way until right now. But yeah, yeah. I mean, so, you know, it's like you go through your life. And you do a lot of things that you do out of obligation or because it seems like a good idea. You can make money off it, whatever. And this book was probably my worst idea. It wasn't it wasn't going to be a huge seller. It's not like people have asked me in interviews. I've been asked a lot. Why do you think people are so fascinated by the USFL? And I always say the same honest answer. I don't think they are. I think you have to convince them why they should be. You know?
Yeah,
I think it is the most fascinating story I've ever written. It's the most interesting league I've ever written about. The characters are insane. But are millions of Americans talking about the USFL day to day? No, not even close. No. But maybe they will. Maybe they'll take a break and, you know, from the madness of our country right now and talk about it a little.
Yeah. So one more thing on David Dixon. Do you think he should be someone who's held in higher esteem? Because as I said, I haven't really heard anything of him, but he bought the NFL, what is now the NFL, to New Orleans, and all that culture that is for that city, that area, especially over the last, with everything that happened there in this last decade or so. But he doesn't seem to be talked about or held in the regard that others around who did the things he did around that time are. Do you think he should be held in higher regard?
I don't think he's not held in high regard. He just people don't really remember him.
No.
But if you really think about it, I know this isn't such a sexy answer, but if you really think about it, you know, we're born, we live, we die.
Yeah.
And very few of us, you know, his legacy is the Saints are in the NFL.
Yeah.
Like that's an amazing, amazing legacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's dead. Like he doesn't know if people are talking about him, but they're going to Saints games and there's a team in New Orleans that people have loved. That's an amazing legacy. Most of us don't have legacies that big.
No, that's true. So obviously the thing that really seems to get everyone's attention for the USFL was when they signed Herschel Walker to the New Jersey team he signed with.
Yeah, correct.
But obviously now we see every draft season hundred odd juniors go to the NFL, but he was the first, wasn't he?
He was not the first
to go to the NFL, but him going to USFL was something that kind of got the ball rolling on that end.
Well, what happened is, at that time, you had to be a senior to be drafted in the NFL. You had to be a senior. Herschel Walker was a junior. He was from a very small town called Wrightsville, Georgia. He was from a very poor family. He had just won the Heisman Trophy, which is the biggest trophy in college football. He was a huge, huge figure in college football. This is before, you know, you could see every game on TV, before you had your smartphone. He was it. He was the iconic figure in college football. And he wanted to come out because he wanted to make money for his family. And the NFL wouldn't take him. So he called the USFL, this brand new league, and said, would you pay me to come out? And the New Jersey Generals offered him a huge amount of money. And he did it. And it shocked the NFL, you know, and he was the first. He was the first underclassman, what you call an underclassman, to come out and go pro. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it's something that's is probably forgotten because it's not something that would happen now because of how the rules, college rules mean basketball, you can be one and done, can't you? So it is something where you can point back and say that's where that thing changed, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I actually think Herschel Walker is a guy, his legacy should be much bigger than it is. One, because of that. Yeah. Number two, so the Pro Football Hall of Fame doesn't count USFL statistics. It doesn't even make – in fact, the guys from the USFL who have gotten into the Hall of Fame, it doesn't even mention on their plaques that they played in the USFL, which is really crazy. Herschel Walker still to this day has a single-season rushing record for any league. He ran for 2,411 yards with the Generals in 1985. Now, if you take his USFL stats and add them to his NFL stats, he's a no-brainer Hall of Famer. And – you know, you could ask 1,000 of the most diehard football fans in America who has the professional football single season rushing record, and out of those 1,000, maybe 3 would know it's Herschel Walker.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
No, that's wild. So obviously with Herschel, they did have a pretty impressive roll call when you look back. Jim Kelly, Doug Flutie, Steve Young, Jim Mora was a coach in the yep. inception year. Reggie White. How do they look back on their time in the USFL?
They look at it, I always say, I think they look back at it like a really scary flight to Hawaii. like you're going on vacation to Hawaii, so you're pretty psyched, and you're happy to be there. But then you're on the plane, and it just drops straight down 1,000 feet, and you're terrified. So you're going to tell that story, but you're also going to tell the story of Hawaii. So to me, that's what the USFL, like Steve Young, just as an example, loves the USFL. He considers it the most fun he ever had playing football. Jim Kelly would say the most fun he ever had playing football. They weren't always getting paid on time. The attendance was falling. They had to deal with Donald Trump being crazy. Like, there were a lot of negatives. The TV ratings were high and hot and cold. But ultimately, they would say it was the most fun they've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, but like those five names are held in. I mean, they're five of the biggest names in NFL. I mean, was that a big thing in the early went to get the league off the ground, getting that name recognition? Was that probably one of the biggest things that all the teams had to do, wasn't it?
Yeah, and some did and some didn't.
Yeah, and obviously in the book there's Dan Marino who kind of reneged on it and went to the NFL. I mean, he would have been.
Well, he didn't renege. He was a first draft pick. He never said he would.
Oh, okay.
The thing is, like, a new league comes along. You're the NFL. You're like, yeah, who cares? Like, I'm not worried about this. We're the NFL. And then, you know, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, what the hell just happened here? Like, where did this come from? They're signing Herschel Walker. They're signing this guy. They're signing, like, oh, excuse me. So sorry about that. So they're just like, you know, they're bringing in all these huge names, and all of a sudden the NFL has to take it seriously, and they're terrified. So really scared the crap out of the NFL.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was a league at the time which was quite set in their ways, wasn't it, the NFL?
Yeah, very much so. They were
stodgy,
and they were traditional, and they really viewed, like, they thought when the USFL began, what the NFL basically said to college players was, you're not going to join. Why would you join this league when you can come to our league? Why would you ever do that? And it was this arrogance. This is pure arrogance that sort of proved to be misplaced, because a lot of guys just wanted the money or the excitement of trying a new league.
Yeah. Obviously, some of the stories in the book, I mean, as I said to you, I'm only a few chapters in, but it was delivered over the weekend. They're just absolutely unbelievable. And obviously, we live in a time where everything is on social media, but one story I read, which I read online, was the one around the owner of San Antonio, and just imagining that happening now with all the social media, as I said, available, that would be quite something to go through from the outside now, wouldn't it? If you can share that story about the San Antonio owner.
Wait, I didn't hear the first part. Which story were you referring to?
There's the one. With the owner of the San Antonio team, the Gunslingers.
Oh, yeah.
Stanky. Well,
Gil Stanky. No, Gil Stanky was the coach. Clint Mangus was the owner.
Okay.
The coach, he hired a coach. So this was a guy who didn't know what he was doing. He bought a team. He didn't know what he was doing. He hired a coach who hadn't coached in 10 years. And he coached at a very small college when he did coach. And he had seven fingers because he lost three in a lawn mowing accident. And which is funny because he also had their star defensive back was the son of a one-armed mechanic. So they had all kinds of crazy things going on there. The coach would sit in the stands. He actually coached from the stands. He would sit next to his wife with a walkie-talkie and call in plays, which is crazy. they played in a high school stadium there where they added seats to it. They painted the field with this spray paint, industrial spray paint. Like, you're supposed to paint a field with sort of this certain kind of paint that is skin-friendly, but they were too cheap. So they used spray paint. And when players would slide on the paint, it would open up these big cuts on their body. So guys would be taking showers after the games with paint wedged in their cuts. They were just cheaper than cheap than cheap. And they, their general manager was this guy, Bud Han, who was a 71-year-old Korean War vet. And they had their offices in a trailer park in the parking lot. They were two trailers in the parking lot of the stadium. And when they stopped paying players, players would show up and knock on his door demanding money. And he would climb out the window and run away. Like, it's the craziest team ever. And the best thing is they had a player who they stopped paying, this guy Greg Fields. I mean, they stopped paying everyone, but this guy, Greg Fields, was kind of crazy. He once punched his coach in the face, and he followed the owner home one day and pulled up to the owner's house and with a baseball bat and said to the owner, you haven't paid me, and I see where you live. I think you should pay me. And the owner went into his house and came back out with $17,000 in cash and said, are we good? He said, we're good. And I just want to say, the other thing about the Gunslingers is they're the only team in any sport anywhere in the world where a player was put on the injured list because he slammed his penis in a trunk.
I saw that on Good Morning Football with those guys over there. That is quite an amazing story.
I don't know. Has that ever happened in any of your local?
not. Well, there's quite secretive about injuries over here. But Adam, my co-host, is with a sports team who, to his chagrin, are quite very secretive about how long the longevity of injuries and stuff. So I've never heard of that. And did laugh quite guffawed when I heard that story regaled on Good Morning Football. Another name who's popped up in the book already is quite a character, is Jeff Gaylord, who played for the Rams. Is that right?
Jeff Gaylord. He played for the Rams, then he played for the Breakers, and then he played for the Gunslingers.
That's quite a habit he had.
You know what's funny about that is nobody's asked about him. That's how crazy this book is. Being serious, he's like the craziest guy in 99 out of 100 books. He's your crazy character. In my book, he's just like another guy. Jeff Gaylord. So he played football at Wichita State in Kansas for college. And to make money on the side, he worked as a bouncer at a bar. And it was a strip bar for women. And one night, one of the strippers called in sick. So they asked him if he would strip. And he stripped. He painted himself green, called himself the Incredible Hulk, danced. And when he was in the USFL, he played for the Breakers. And the Breakers played in New Orleans, Louisiana. And New Orleans was, as you know, Mardi Gras. It's a very crazy town. And he said everyone on the team used to just snort cocaine nonstop. He said they couldn't play in New Orleans because it was just too much cocaine. So they ended up moving. He got traded to the Gunslingers. He still did drugs in San Antonio, but he also, when he was there, he was on the injured list with some injury, and he started working out at a gym where they worked on wrestling. And Jeff Gaylord is one of five USFL players to go into professional wrestling when he was done with the football. It's crazy.
There's Dr. Death as well, isn't he? He's
possibly, Oh, nice job.
There's a film, it's about 15, 20 years ago over here, called Mike Bassett, England manager, who it was about a fictional soccer manager who becomes England manager, and when he names his first squad, is mistakenly names two people in their late 40s with surnames Benson and Hedges because he wrote the squad down on the back of a cigarette packet.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's kind of what happened with Albert Lynch, isn't it, in Chicago?
So Albert C. Lynch, another guy who would be a star of every other book. So the Chicago Blitz were a new team in 1983, and they did all these tryouts. And they would try out, they ended up trying out 300 people, auditioning 300 people for football jobs. And they held this one day. They held a camp at Soldier Field in Chicago. And anyone could come and try out, and you get a free T-shirt, and you try out. And if they sign you, if you're one of the few they sign, you get invited to another mini camp. And if they sign you, you go up into the stands, and Bruce Allen, the general manager, is waiting there with a contract, and he signs you to a contract. So all these tryouts are going on, and the few good players are sent to the stands. Well, there's a guy, Albert C. Lynch, who was like a 5'8" linebacker. He had no business playing football. He was terrible. But he notices that all the good players are going into the stands and walking away with contracts. So he walks into the stands, and he goes up to Bruce Allen, and he signs a contract. And after the workout is over, one of the coaches is looking over the guys who signed, and he says, why did you sign Albert C. Lynch? He said, well, why did you send me Albert C. Lynch? He's saying, I didn't send you Albert C. Lynch. He said, you certainly did send me Albert C. Lynch. He came up here and signed the contract. And they finally figured out that Albert C. Lynch had gamed the system, which is great. So that's how he's there.
It's amazing. So it just seems like there's like a rebel outlaw mentality all through all the stories, all through all the players and even the owners. Is that something you think that has benefited the legend of the league, do you think, overall?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think football leagues come and go, and sports leagues come and go, and a lot of them are forgettable, and a lot of teams are forgettable. But the USFL, it just felt, at a time when the NFL was very, very suit and tie, and we don't want to celebrate, And we don't want you, we want you to pay attention to our team names, but not our players. The USFL was just this wild circus. You know, it was just a circus. I think someone said, there was a member of the San Antonio Gunslingers at the time who was interviewed. He was a quarterback named Whit Taylor. And he said, when I was a boy, I had two dreams. I wanted to play football and I wanted to join the circus. Thanks to USFL, I did both. I feel like that's the USFL.
Yeah. Yeah, that's some. You mentioned Bruce Allen. Is that the Bruce Allen who's at the Redskins, or is that just a common name?
Same guy.
That's madness. So obviously, George Allen, who owned that team, obviously at one point decided he didn't want to fly as far anymore. Can you go through that story quickly? Obviously, it's, we're as Seahawks fans, we're waiting for Earl Thomas to be traded, but this was a lot bigger operation of being traded, wasn't it?
Wait, I didn't hear the first part. I'm sorry.
So that's okay. So with George Allen, obviously, he's the owner of Chicago, who he decided one day that he didn't want to travel as far.
Oh, no, no. All right, so this is what happened. That's the story of it. Okay. So Ted Dietrich was the owner of the Chicago Blitz.
Okay.
And he was a doctor who lived in Arizona, but he owned the Blitz. He decided after the first season he did not enjoy taking the flight from Arizona to Chicago because it was 3 hours on a chartered plane. And, you know, that really messed with his schedule. So only in the USFL would the solution be, well, let's just trade the teams for each other. So they took all 50-whatever guys on the Chicago Blitz. They took all 50 guys on the Arizona Wranglers. They made all the Blitz the Wranglers and made all the Wranglers the Blitz. The Wranglers changed their name to the new Arizona Wranglers. And there are a few funny offsets of that. Number one, the year before, the Chicago Blitz were very good. The Arizona Wranglers were very bad. So they were traded for each other. So now the Chicago Blitz were very bad and the Arizona Wranglers were very good. And the new coach of the Chicago Blitz was this guy, Marv Levy, who later went on to coach the Buffalo Bills. Marv Levy was hired without being told that he was taking over a crappy team. So he shows up and he's like, where is everybody? What is this dog crap I've inherited? And the other thing is, the new owner of the Chicago Blitz was this guy, James Hoffman, who had been he also was a doctor and he bought the Blitz. And the team was terrible. Nobody wanted to see them play. And after the second exhibition game, he's walking off the field with a player named Dan Jiggins. And he says to Dan, he goes, I'm out of here. And Dan Jiggins says, oh, where are you going? He's like, no, I'm out of here. I'm done with this. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, I don't want to own this team anymore. I'm just done. And he didn't sell the team. He didn't give the team to a friend. He just left it on the side of the road. The owner of the Chicago Blitz just decided, I don't want to own this team anymore, so I'm just going to leave it here for you guys. And the USFL had to take it over. And the funny thing is, the USFL took it over. The league had to run the team. They fired everyone making good money. So they fired the general manager of the team. And on the day they fired him, he locked himself in his office and started calling all the local media, telling them that everything was just insane and that the whole team was a joke. So... oh, and Marv Levy had to bring his own toilet paper. That's how cheap they were. He had to bring his own. The head coach, a guy who had coached the Buffalo Bills in the 4 straight Super Bowls, was buying toilet paper.
So, as people listening can obviously tell, if you need to buy the book, because some of these stories are absolutely incredible. Is there any ones that didn't make the book that you could share?
No, I'm going to be honest. On this one, I kind of emptied my notebook. I'm sure there are ones, but I wasn't trying to hide anything or hold anything back. And usually if there are things that you don't use, it's because either you can't prove them or, you know, you're not trying to embarrass anyone. So if there's a story that's really, you know, whatever, about some guy and his, you know, they're just, I'll tell you one story. My friend insists it's the best story in the book. I don't think it is, but he keeps telling me, you need to tell this story. So I'll give it to you real quick. There was a guy in the San Antonio Gunslingers named Jim Bob Morris, and he was a safety, so he played defense. And he was living in San Antonio, and he was getting lots of sex. He was having sex all the time because he was a football player, and they were a big deal in San Antonio. So all the time, he'd go out to bars, and all these guys were having sex. Well, he had a girlfriend who lived in Kansas, and his girlfriend would come and visit. And he didn't want his girlfriend to know that he was cheating on her, but he also didn't want the girls to stop calling him. So he hired an electrician to put an answering machine in his wall that he could check when his girlfriend wasn't there. So he had it embedded in his wall, and people, the young ladies would leave him messages, but she wouldn't hear them. And when she wasn't there, she'd go to the bathroom and he would open the wall and check the answering machine to see who was calling him. So there you go.
That is amazing. There's a story Keith Richards book about a car that they hid loads of drugs in, and they crashed it. And before the police could search it, they scarpered. So he said in the book, there's a car somewhere in Indiana with like 6-7 grand worth of cocaine stuffed in the
that's
door.
That's awesome. Yeah, well, someone right now is living in an apartment in San Antonio and does not know there's an answer machine in the wall.
Yeah. So as I said, it is a fascinating story. Which when I saw the book, I thought, yeah, I need to get a hold of that. And obviously, since the 30 for 30 small potatoes, which focuses on someone who's even more infamous and prominent now than he was back then. But I didn't realize that Donald Trump got involved so early on. But
yeah.
Before we get into all that happened later on, but so obviously he was there, supposed to be there on day one, wasn't he?
Yeah, so he was supposed to be the original owner of the New York franchise. And in 1982, they had a meeting in San Francisco of all the owners, and he was going to come. And the phone rings, and they put it on speaker. And it's this guy no one's ever heard of named Donald Trump. And he says, yeah, this is Donald. So bad news. Not going to do it. Sorry. Good talking to you. Bye. And that was it. But then he bought in after the 83 seasons, or after the first season, he bought the New Jersey Generals because they were for sale. He liked what the USFL was doing, and he bought it. And I can tell you more about it, or you can – I mean, you tell me.
Yeah, no.
I mean, he ruined the league. I don't know what you think of Donald Trump. I think he's the worst. I'm embarrassed by him. It's humiliating. Being here right now is humiliating. I always tell people in different countries, please don't judge us all on this, you know, moron. It's funny because I always say, people say like, oh, you're biased against Trump. And I always say, you try researching a book about the USFL and liking him. It's impossible.
Yeah, no.
I mean, he bought the team after 1 year. The USFL had pretty good success the first year. It wasn't perfect, but good success. He buys a team. In the lead up to buying the team, he tells everyone how great the USFL is. Spring football, he's very happy. He buys a team. As soon as he owns the Generals, we need to move to fall. Fall's where the action is. We need to move to fall. He has a secret meeting with the commissioner of the NFL, Pete Rozelle. He says to Pete Rozelle, I don't care about the USFL. I want an NFL team. What do I have to do to get in the NFL? Pete Rozelle says, as long as I'm the commissioner, you'll never be in this league. Because he thinks he sees him as a con man. He just sees through him immediately. Trump then starts lying to his other owners, saying there is all this money to be made in fall. He's been talking to TV executives. They want the USFL in fall. It's all a lie. It's not like a fib. It's not like a misunderstanding. He just flat out lied. Then he leads the lawsuit. The USFL ends up suing the NFL because they want to play in the fall, and they say the NFL is monopolized TV, meaning they can't get a TV deal anywhere. So Trump promises the other owners, if we sue them, either the NFL is going to, they're going to back out and we're going to win. Well, he sues them. It's a disaster. It's an utter disaster. The USFL wins a dollar. The league dies. And Donald Trump just walks away. Meanwhile, all these guys lost their way of making a living, their love, their careers. And he dismissed it. You saw the 30 for 30. He just dismisses it. Small potatoes. Small potatoes.
Yeah. That meeting with Rozelle is something you touched on Rich Eisen. that is what started every term with obviously Kaepernick and all the anthem stuff and his obsession with TV ratings for every TV show ever made. It's not that unlikely to suggest that distaste for the NFL started by that cold line so eloquently delivered by the NFL commissioner, Pete Rozelle. I mean, that's not too wild an assumption to make, is it?
No. I mean, I always say it this way. Donald Trump tried buying the Baltimore Colts in 1980 and failed. He tried getting Pete Rozelle to give him an NFL team and failed. He tried suing the NFL and failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills and failed. He thought about buying the New England Patriots and failed. For a guy who hates the NFL as much as he seems to hate the NFL, he sure wanted to be a part of the NFL.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, as I always say, Donald Trump, when he was an owner of a USFL team, would do work during the national anthem. Like, he would sit down and be on the phone and do work. And I don't have a problem with that. I've done work during the national anthem, too. Like, big deal. It's not that big a deal. But this whole thing about Kaepernick and kneeling, it's all nonsense. It's utter nonsense. You know, I'm a New Yorker. I'm from New York. I live in California now, but I'm from New York. And I still consider 9/11 the worst day of my life. And Donald Trump has lied about going down to ground zero and volunteering. He never did. He gave $0 and 0 cents to 9/11 causes. He lied about people celebrating on their roofs in New Jersey, Muslims celebrating after 9/11. He mocked John McCain, a POW. Mm. He's done so little of any sort of any. I can't think of anything he's done to show any sort of patriotism or love of country. And all of a sudden, when it comes to African-Americans kneeling and having a private protest, a silent protest, he's up in arms. It's just all fraud. It's a con. It's just a pure con. It disgusts me.
Yeah, I'm with the NFL. It's, as we just said, it's just kind of the perfect storm for him to have a platform for his distaste for it, for the league, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's amazing how many people fall for this. You know, like,
yeah,
you doesn't take. You don't have to be me. You don't have to be a guy who researches NFL for a year to understand that this is all just a con. Yeah. But people just buy it. People are, you know, people are simple.
Yeah, but on the legal case, he pushed. I think you spoke to one of the jurors who said that, who voted in, because obviously they did win the case, but they only got the three bucks. Did they get $3?
It was a dollar, and under the law, it was tripled to three.
And it was what? It was a $1 billion suit, wasn't it?
I was they were trying to win $1.3 billion.
Wow. Yeah. So they had the merit. It just wasn't worth the danger that came with it, which, as we saw, was the folding of the league. Is that fair?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What the jury decided basically is that the USFL was right in everything they were saying.
Yeah.
But that ultimately the fault was also the USFL's, that they were their own fault, that they were their own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. So the jury had, you know, and they heard Donald Trump testify and they just didn't buy it. And the NFL made Donald Trump their star. Like, they thought he was the best thing for their case because he came off as a bully.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just fascinating how it just, rise and fall of it. Also, I'm a massive wrestling fan, so obviously Vince McMahon had the XFL, 15 years later, and that flamed out even more spectacularly. So it's a big what if, but if the league has stayed on track in spring, summer, didn't have the longevity chance to threaten the NFL, or do you think that's just a what if and
most of it? I think what would have happened is so there was a strike. The NFL had a player strike in 1987, and it was really chaotic, and you had a lot of, you know, players looking for work all of a sudden. And I think a couple of USFL teams would have been absorbed. First of all, the USFL could have gotten a lot more players that year, and I think ultimately a lot of the USFL teams would have been absorbed. I think Jacksonville would have been absorbed. I think Tennessee would have been absorbed.
Yeah.
I think you would have had a bunch of USFL teams wind up in the NFL.
Yeah. So watching some clips, and I think you mentioned somewhere as well, you see a lot of things in the game, in the XFL, schematically especially, mm-hmm. which you now see every Sunday, every Monday night. But as I said, with the XFL, you saw they changed how the sport was broadcast. But just quickly explain how the USFL schematically had an impact on the game.
Oh, man, so many ways. Number one, just on the rule book, two-point conversion, coaches challenge were both USFL. The big one, play-wise, was you had in Houston offense called the run and shoot. And that meant you put four or five wide receivers on the field, no tight end, no fullback, sometimes no running back. And you just threw it all over the field. So quarterback would drop back three steps instead of five, and just bing, 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 throw, 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 quick throws, quick slants, quick outs, back to the line of scrimmage. They would run the no huddle offense, which is an offense that's usually run at the end of a game. They would run it all game. So it'd be quick. It'd be exhausting. The defense couldn't catch up. And all of a sudden, NFL teams started using that too. So there was a lot of sort of high octane offense. And one other thing they did, I didn't even mention in the book because I didn't think about it, is in the NFL at the time, wide receiver, this isn't that big a deal, but it's kind of interesting. Wide receivers could only wear numbers between 80 and 89. And the USFL let wide receivers wear any number between 1 and 19 and 80 and 89. So you had a lot of guys wearing number 1, number 12, playing wide receiver. And it just looks cool. Like, there's something cool about seeing a guy wearing number 1 darting down the field. So little things like that, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's quarterbacks now, I think, 1? Or is it just kickers?
It was quarterbacks and kickers. You could be
a quarterback. Yeah, so as you said, you mentioned briefly a few minutes ago, Jacksonville and Tennessee, but before the USFL, they weren't NFL cities. Yeah. I mean, that's a big footprint that the USFL had, isn't it? Because you got, like, San Antonio is not an NFL team there currently. But, no. I mean, that's a big part of the legacy that you got the sport in those cities.
Agree. Yeah, very much so. Huge.
Yeah. So is the league giving its due for the impact it had on the cities and how the schematically it changed things? Now, obviously, back to Herschel Walker, how it changed how the college players ascend up to the professional ranks. Do you think it's given its due for the impact, or is it kind of looked at with a bit of side eye?
I don't think it's given its due at all. No. I don't think at all. No, I really don't. I think most people have no idea. Most people don't know. It kind of breaks my heart because it was a great league, but most people just don't know. Yeah, they don't.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I can't wait to get through the books. Some of these stories are just insane. One thing, as I said in the intro, you wrote another bestseller, Gunslinger, on Brett Favre. I mean, he was about a decade too late, wasn't he? He'd have been perfect for the USFL.
Yeah, he actually would have been because he was a second round pick.
Yeah.
In the NFL, and I could see a USFL team taking him in the first round and him jumping. There are a lot of guys. There are a lot of guys who would have been really good USFL players. I mean, Tim Tebow would have been a really interesting USFL player. You know, there are a lot of guys, small running backs who maybe the NFL wouldn't use sort of every down, would be great USFL players because the game was so fast.
Yeah.
Just, it's really interesting. It's very intriguing to think what could have been.
Yeah. Do you think the NFL would net positive impact from a league like USFL existing now? Because obviously there's a lot made of how there's so little contact during practice, during the off season, which is so long. Do you think that it's a landscape which kind of needs another secondary league like the USFL, or do you think that's no?
I don't. I mean, I would love to say yes.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I think. The one thing that's changed from then to now is, so when I was growing up watching football, you would only watch on Sunday and then Monday night. And that was it. That was it. That was all for your football. And then you'd read the newspaper and you'd see what was going on. But that was it. Now, it's on Sunday night, Monday night, Thursday night. The NFL Network is on all the time.
Yeah.
Football, there's fantasy football. It's just nonstop. So I feel like, I don't think we need more football in America.
No.
I think it's overkill.
Yeah, and also there's the college game. I think this week there's games on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
So,
it's non-stop.
It's only Tuesday, which doesn't have it. Just quickly before I let you go, again, I do appreciate you taking the time. One thing off the USFL, researching this and looking at all the clips, your interview with John Rocker back in the day, I mean, that's an incredible read. What was that all like? Obviously, the actual interview process and all the fallout from it, which I guess at the time was something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was. He was a baseball player here in Atlanta, in America, and he was he was kind of a racist asshole. And you know, it was. I mean, I went into it just thinking I was writing about a baseball player, and then we're driving around, and he starts telling me all the people he hates, and you know, it was just a crazy. I look back at that and think, did that even really happen? You know, it was so unusual and so weird. So it was crazy. I don't have a great answer. It was insane. No. I never experienced anything like that before. Hopefully, I never will.
So when people pick up this book, because obviously I encourage them wholeheartedly to do that. What do you want them to take away from it, from the league, and from all the work you've put into this project? What do you want people to take away from when they turn the last page?
Honestly, I just want people to, you know, there's a lot of stress in the world and there's a lot of hard stuff going on in the world. Like, if you can read this book and get a good enjoyment and have whatever it takes, a couple of days of just kicking back and laughing and a sense of nostalgia, I'm very happy about that. That's all. I don't, you know, it's not about legacy. I don't,
no.
I mean, I would love for more people to appreciate the USFL, but ultimately I hope they enjoy themselves.
Yeah, well, I say I'm about 40-50 pages in, and I am thoroughly enjoying it, and I can't wait to read it on my flight, which I'm off to Arizona for the Seahawks game this weekend in a couple of days. So I can't wait to spend my flight reading all of that. So, who did you have a USFL team while you were watching?
Yeah, I was a Generals fan because I grew up in New York.
Oh, yeah.
So I was a big Generals fan.
Are you an NFL fan now?
Nah. I mean, I don't dislike it, but I don't I don't watch a ton. You know, my son is a Giants fan because we're from New York.
Yeah. I was at MetLife Stadium last year for the Seahawks game. That's some stadium down there.
Oh, yeah.
In the Meadowlands. But yeah, if people want to get a hold of the book, it's called Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Where can people get hold of it?
You can go anywhere online. You can also go, if you go to my website, jeffperlman.com, there are a million different options. So it's all over the place.
Yeah, and social media, just give quick plug so people can show you that they're buying it and all that.
I'm mainly at Twitter. At Jeff Perlman on Twitter. And then, again, jeffperlman.com is my website. Those are the main places.
Cool. As I keep saying, massive, massive thanks for taking the time out of your day. I appreciate you really busy with the book release. As I said, I watched all the stuff you did for the NFL Network over the weekend, so massively appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm thoroughly enjoying the book thus far, and thank you for writing about the USFL, because, as I said, it's something that's really caught my attention in the last few years.
Thank you so much. I'm really flattered.
No worries. Thank you.
All right, take care.
What's going on, guys? This is Michael Robinson, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast.
So yeah, as I say, a massive, massive thanks to Jeff Perlman. If you haven't already, get on Amazon, get on his website and order the book. I'm about 4 or 5 chapters in, and some of the stories, as you heard there, are just absolutely incredible. Just absolutely batshit for the most part. And obviously there's a big part, as an overhanging cloud, which is in the shape and form of Donald Trump with that league. So it is a really interesting book, and weirdly well timed as well with where Mr. Trump is currently. But moving on, this week 4 the Seahawks head back on the road, and I will be there this Sunday as they head back into the University of Phoenix Stadium, which is apparently now called State Farm Field, to face Josh Rosen and the Arizona Cardinals. We'll start with the quarterback, Adam. Josh Rosen is now, we're going to get to see him. I mean, it was really a bit unfair what they did to him on Sunday, wasn't it? Putting him in at that time in the game when the team was kind of floundering.
It was insane. They completely hung the gouts dry. And I couldn't believe that. I mean, I guess as a fan, you'd sort of want to put the guy in because what have you got to lose at the time? And Bradford was just doing nothing. But it was a bit of a surprise to see him be put out there at that time, and especially taking David Johnson out for a coaching point.
They what?
Did you not see this? So yeah. David Johnson was taken out for the crucial third down they had because apparently he missed a blitz pickup on second down, and was told to go and speak to the running back coach. So he wasn't on the field for the crucial third down because the best running back in the league, in my opinion, to go and have a coaching point.
What on earth is that about? Josh Rosen is now the starting quarterback. Sam Bradford, as Adam said, was truly awful through 2 of the big games. He threw 2 touchdowns and 4 interceptions for just 400 yards. He was not good. But with Josh Rosen, we'll get onto him back in a minute because the usage of David Johnson was a bit strange through the first 3 weeks. This could be like nothing to lose for him at this point, because it's obviously his first game. They're really on a hide into nothing, aren't they? So he could be the loosest he's going to be all season with expectations follow if he does play well on Sunday. Is that fair?
Yeah, I thought he was going to be the least ready of the guys drafted in the first round. He doesn't particularly do it for me, Rosen, to be honest. And I think that we really should be looking to capitalize. He might completely prove me wrong and be great, but he's the kind of guy that I think needed a redshirt year. So I think Bradford being as terrible as he has been is a real letdown for the Cardinals, who, although they did give Bradford way too much money, that the sense of doing what they did seem reasonable. Yeah. And as much as Rosen probably has sort of a free shot at it, I think the Seahawks defense have an absolute free shot to just get after this guy and knock him about, because you're not soft if you have concussion issues. That'd be ridiculous to say, but he has been an injury prone, and a guy who doesn't have the stature of a Josh Allen or a Mahomes, who look like fully grown men at this stage. Rosen's still a little bit wiry, and this should be the kind of time where the defense should be licking their lips.
Yeah, it could be a deer in the headlights situation, so they can.
That's what you'd hope for, yeah.
Yeah. Elsewhere for their offense, as we said, David Johnson has been used somewhat bizarrely. Just 116 yards through three games and just one touchdown. But probably the stranger part, which could change with Josh Rosen, is the receptions, where he's only had 10 for 63 yards. He was a Swiss Army knife for a running back 2 years ago. It was 2017, was it week three? He was injured and was out for the rest of the year. But they're kind of wasting, as you call the best running back in the league, Adam.
It's a little bit of my similar frustration with Schottenheimer and Wilson, I think. The fact that you've got this absolute just phenom of a player and you're just like reining it in out of choice. It doesn't seem to make any sense. I mean, as long as they remain a division rival, long may that continue. But it does seem very strange what they're doing with him. I mean, even if you look at the route trees that he's been running, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it's all quick outs or it just runs up the middle. They just don't seem to be using this, as you say, an absolute Swiss Army knife of a player to get the best out of him. Very strange.
But maybe with a quarterback who you'd expect is going to run, do things a little differently to Bradford, maybe that will open it up, which is not ideal timing for the Seahawks. But while we said last week that this is probably the other team who's got the worst receiving core in the league, Larry Fitzgerald obviously still there, age 35, is leading the way. But outside of that, we have 22-year-old rookie Christian Kirk, 23-year-old tight end Ricky Seals-Jones, and 24-year-old second-year player, I think it's a fifth-round pick at Grambling State back in 2017, Chad Williams. They don't have a lot on the outside of the ball, do they? Outside.
No, I mean, is John Brown still there?
No, he's in...
Is it Baltimore now?
Baltimore, yeah.
Blimey, yeah. I mean, they really don't have a lot going for them. Strange time for Arizona because they never really got to capitalize on what they had in their really good year. And obviously they lost Carson Palmer, but I mean, they really have had a quite dramatic decline. I mean, I guess a lot of team people think that about the Seahawks, but
yeah.
The Cardinals have been closer to sort of winning Super Bowl caliber team than we have, I'd say.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, if they're in a rut, then this is the time to take advantage. We messed up the first couple of weeks of the season and we need to get a game back. And this could be a really good opportunity to do that.
Yeah. It would be a little nice, positive, with the getting a road win this season before they make the trip over this side of the pond to London. Cause obviously two defeats for the first 2 weeks on the road, coming into London 0-3 on the road is going to be lingering all week, isn't it?
Yes, especially if it's 0-3 on grass fields, which it would be coming to Wembley as well, which is a not the best of fields. But obviously the problem with Arizona is that it is a completely cursed building for the team. Yeah. And yeah. As a man who believes in all superstitions when it comes to sport, to the point where I've worn coats in pubs to watch Arsenal lose games, let alone just to watch Spurs. These things matter, and it does worry me that the number of Seahawk-based things that have crumbled in that stadium, it could be that maybe another thing is going to come crumbling down on that hellhole of a place.
Yeah, for people who haven't been keeping score, which I'm sure a lot of people have, last year obviously we saw Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor's career and Seahawks' career come to a grinding halt. Stephen Hauschka probably lost his job in the desert, was it 2 years ago now? And obviously Super Bowl 49 and all that happened on the 1 yard line in the end zone. Luckily, opposite to the one I'm sitting in on Sunday. It's not a great place, but maybe the change of name was something that Paul Allen urged the money makers at State Farm to push through. Maybe they think the change of name is going to bring a change of look at them.
Do we think he bought State Farm?
Maybe. He's got enough money. He's been donating money left, right, and centre to all sorts, isn't he? Mr. Allen has. But on the defensive side of the ball, as you said, there's been a weird talent just departures in their droves. Buda Baker is... him and Patrick Peterson are the top guys in that secondary. Then you got Chandler Jones, who was the leading sack artist last year in the entire league. It's not... a lot of name recognition, just like the Seahawks, really, isn't it, on the defensive side of the ball?
Is Marcus Golden still there? He's a guy that always gives us problems.
If I'm guessing he's still there, but he hasn't played this season.
Has he not?
No.
Well, he's someone that always worries me. Let's have a look, see if I can find him.
Well, Sam Bradford has more tackles than him anyway.
Golden was active against the Bears, but maybe he just didn't.
No, he hasn't played a game.
He hasn't played a snap yet.
No, that's very strange.
So that's nice. He's set up for a comeback of the year award on Sunday, as per all things.
Yeah, but like name recognition has lost. It's again similar to what the Seahawks, as you said, isn't it? It's just not quite there yet.
Yeah, and the coach, you know, Steve Wilks, doesn't necessarily seem to be the most invigorating of guys either. So I wonder if there's just a little bit of a malaise going on in Arizona, and certainly that they're not. When you've got Bruce Arians and Carson Palmer and Larry Fitzgerald and David Johnson, they were just such a talked about team. And actually, on their All or Nothing show, I mean, I know you don't like Bruce Arians, but I quite like the guy, and they seem like a really nice, fun team to watch, and a good group of guys. But that all seems to have fallen by the wayside a bit, and they're almost like the forgotten team of the NFC this season.
Yeah, they are. It's very, very strange. But Robert Nkendiche was a first round pick 2 years ago. It seems to finally be popping up this year. He's got 2 sacks through 3 games, 7 tackles, 3 assists, and that's an interior guy, which could cause us some problems. But obviously Chandler Jones is the next on the line of the death row of pass rushes for Jermaine Ifedi to keep out of Russell Wilson's grill, isn't he?
Yeah, well, if Ifedi can play like he did on Sunday, then we might be alright, because he did pretty well against DeMarcus Lawrence.
Yeah, he did.
And, you know, every clock's right twice a day. Let's hope that's not the same with Ifedi. And there's some actual there's actual progression there versus just having one good day because the stars were aligned in the right way for him.
But through 3 games, the Arizona Cardinals have just 20 points through 3 games, which is quite anemic, is probably the fairest way to say it. So confidence and prediction, Adam?
I am confident, actually, and I think we will win by about 6 points. So let's go. Is 29 possible? Not really.
Yeah.
How's it possible? 29.
That is quite hard, actually. 7.5. We need a safety, or we need a hell of a lot of work by Janikowski.
Or one missed point extra. So let's go 29-23 Seattle.
Okay, I am confident. I do think Sunday will just give the, like I said last week, a groundswell of confidence for this team. I'm going to go 30-16 to the Seahawks. I think the defense is probably going to have a bit of a nightmare with David Johnson, but I do think this defense is there for the picking. Obviously, you'd expect Patrick Peterson to follow Tyler Lockett around, because he seems to be someone that does do that follow thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, unless they want to go more physical against Brandon Marshall. Peterson. I mean, they may not see anyone there that's necessarily worthy of being followed, with all due respect to our guys.
that's a very good point. Let's hope they escape the win. I do hope I go all that way and melt, completely and utterly melt, with my body temperature, which is about the same as the sun.
Bikram NFL fanning.
I'm sweating snowstorms, so it's going to be an interesting week when it's 38, 39 degrees all weekend. But I am looking forward to it, seeing all the Seahawks fans making a trip from all over America as well. I think I am. Well, the only one in the group anyway making the trip out, so that should be fun.
Where are you tailgating?
Trip. Salt, apparently, which is a bar in Glendale. I think it's where Softy does. I think Softy does his show there last Thursday night. I swear I've seen Softy there before on his Twitter. They say it's like the Seahawks pub near in Glendale, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So yeah, should be good. There's Saturday night with Lawyer Malloy and Roy Lewis as well, so that should be pretty fun. Moving on quickly to wrap up. It's time for, I've actually got people this week. Get in the bin.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions
as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, this week's Get in the Bin. I'm going to go first because I've got two this week. I'm going to start with my possibly someone I've waited. How long have we been doing this, Adam? 7 weeks?
Yeah, I think we were even doing it last year. So
Okay. So like a good three months worth of Get in the Bins. And I don't think I've yet put him in. I think he's on the intro. Mr. Colin Cowherd and whoever the absolute mount was with him on Friday. On his, again, as I say, his terrible Fox Sports show. They said that Baker Mayfield was on his phone too quickly after the final whistle. And he's quite clearly, because Baker Mayfield got him, not just when he was on his show a few months ago, we completely shut him down, but he also got him on the Thursday night post-game set when Joe Thomas asked him if he had a message for Mr. Cowherd. And Baker Mayfield basically said, "I don't give a flying fook." So Colin Cowherd and Jason McIntyre, I think that was just, come on, lads, give it up. I mean, his phone. Tom Brady was on his phone after the Super Bowl.
But they weren't even saying he was on his phone. If I'm right in saying this, he was holding his phone.
Yeah, after the game. I mean, it's 2018. Players are pretty social media active, and they have people. I mean, yeah, it was so weak and so tenuous, and it was quite so obvious. It was Jason McIntyre who said it was so clear that Colin Cowherd just went before, look, I can't say this because you'll come after me. Can you say this? It was so obvious. It was one of them. Colin Cowherd can get in the bin. My second one is Dave Portnoy, Barstool Sports. You absolute piece of work. I can't remember who it was. He published an email he received from a journalist who was asking for a quote for a story, and sent his minions after this journalist and after this article. Dave Portnoy is... Barstool Sports is not great. Dave Portnoy is the all-time worst. There's a video of him leaving Jacksonville last week, crying after a week 2 defeat. He's the absolute worst. And yeah, don't do that. Literally, it was just an email asking for a quote for a story that this guy was writing.
From a female journalist?
I'm not sure. I think it might have been BuzzFeed.
Okay, because there's a big thing about Barstool, how they've been treating female journalists recently.
That's always the thing. Pat McAfee is someone who, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I think he's absolute hilarious. He's for the brand stuff, especially on College Football Saturdays. He's just the best. He couldn't put up with him any longer, and he was seriously bringing the money in for that organization. Yeah, he's just an awful, toxic company, and he's the lead guy on that. So yeah, Dave Portnoy, Colin Cowherd, Jason McIntyre, get in the bin, please, gents. Adam?
Hard not to put the entire NFL in the bin this week. And I know that's quite a broad thing to do, but I'm the kind of guy to do it anyway. I just think with this roughing the passer nonsense, I am for player safety. Obviously, everyone is. And I do find, I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the bravado when it's like, whoa, we used to hit like this back in the day or whatever. But the roughing the passer rule is just not feasible and not realistic in order to keep the game going in the right way. I mean, Clay Matthews, it's quite funny to see him get absolutely belted a couple of times with this rule and arguably cost the Packers a couple of games. But it's just silly. And if you cut, even the one the Seahawks got in the opening play, I think our opening drive on Sunday, it was ridiculous. And the game can't function like that because otherwise you're just never going to be able to touch the guy and then you've got no game. And so I think that needs to get right in the bin because it's something that's going to ruin the sport going forward.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple last time. I mean, like football, it was like every drive there was at least one. I think Jason Witten just stopped talking about it, which, if you've heard Jason Witten's commentary, is probably not a bad thing. but yeah, it's just, I mean, the one on The one on Russell Wilson was such a big play because it was like we were on like the 4 yard line, weren't we?
Yeah, I think it was hit and on the he was hit on the two.
Yeah, I mean that's a 50 yard play. That's a field position thing, which is such a big thing for Pete Carroll. But then the one on Quinton Jefferson, if Troy Aikman isn't agreeing with a call for the Dallas Cowboys, you know it's a stupid rule.
And I mean, maybe they should even change it and like in the same way as they've got touching the kicker and roughing the kicker, like you know, maybe have a rule whereby things like the one on Quinton Jefferson got, like maybe that's just an automatic first down but no yards. But when you get 15 yards and a first down,
yeah,
it's just silly.
Yeah, and especially when you add that with, I think the DPI should be 15 yards. It can't be a spot foul. It's just that it's far too much of a swing in probability, and it just ruins game planning and all, everything. But yeah, the roughing the passer does need. I mean, like the 5 yard, 15 yard thing, kind of like a defensive PI kind of thing. I mean,
yeah, or you have to review them all, which will take time. But in a way,
that's what they do in the CFL.
Yeah, I wonder if any of these roughing the passer things, or you have to make every play reviewable, which is something I think they should have done ages ago. It seems daft to me to have some plays that are reviewable and some plays that are not reviewable. You know, it's not up to the league to choose. If a team wants to blow one of their timeouts on a review on anything, they should be allowed to do it. But I think that something needs to change because it's just not really it's not going to work.
It's against physics what they're trying to see. I mean, they're not like these are big boys where they're at full pout are equally bigger people. It's against physics to ask them to. I mean, we saw William Hayes for the Dolphins try to pull up and his knee exploded. And he's now out for the season. It's cost him, obviously, playing time. It's cost him money and everything else. It's just, if that happens to a Clay Matthews, no matter how much, as you said, he was owed a little bit of this flack with all the cheap shots he's taken over the years. But if that happens to a banner player in this league, that's probably what it's going to take. And that's not right. But it probably is what it's going to take, isn't it?
For someone,
because that's why the rule exists, because Aaron Rodgers got injured by Anthony Barr last year. That's why the rule exists.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with quarterbacks being the most protected players on the field. No. That is right. But some of this is just incidental contact, and it's becoming game-changing. I mean, the one on Kirk Cousins last week was a complete farce.
Yeah, it was. Especially at that juncture of the game as well. Actually, Quinton Jefferson was stupid, but it probably with the scoreboard how it was wasn't make that much of a difference. But yeah, it's just they just seem to throw it at every opportunity. We got people like Ben Roethlisberger who are drama queens anyway. They're just gonna turn into WWE. Just selling every move.
Yeah,
it's gonna be unbelievable. Like Ric Flair's all over the field. Other NFL stuff. Obviously, we did allude to it. You got anyone else, sorry, for the bin before we move on?
Have I got anyone else for the bin? No, but I have seen, I think, my favourite ever thing in the NFL this week.
Oh, the Dolphins.
It is the best thing I've ever, ever seen. So for those of you that have not seen it, there's a pick six
It's a
long touchdown. Is it by Albert Wilson, who's already thrown for one touchdown, which was fantastic. He breaks through and is all on his own, and he's got a blocker with him, another receiver, and on the Raiders' 15-yard line, they have a high five as they both run into the end zone. It is the most disrespectful thing you'll ever see. Oh my goodness, it was brilliant. I'm a big fan of John Gruden. I'm not particularly enjoying some of the crap he's getting with the Raiders, but you know, it comes with the territory. But oh my goodness, that was just incredible.
It is. But I don't think they got. I mean, we're talking about past. I don't think they got flagged for it. I mean, we saw Golden Tate.
Sure you can get flagged for it in the game.
Well, yeah, but we saw Golden Tate when he waved right into the end zone, turning around waving to Janoris Jenkins for the Rams. He got flagged for it. I'm almost certain he did.
Did he get a flag or a fine? Because
I'm almost certain he got flagged.
Okay, well, I have to look at it because I know that you're allowed to flip into the end zone, but you're not allowed to flip in the end zone.
Yeah, it was just the best. It's the best thing since that Golden Tate wave to Joris Jenkins.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Back when they're back in St. Louis. Yeah, but yeah. Also, the thing, there's a picture going. This is a great picture from the Dolphins. Oh, by the way, this is at the 15-yard line.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
it's so good. Other NFL stuff, obviously. Just the NFC West. Absolutely devastating news for Kyle Shanahan, Jimmy Garoppolo, and the 49ers with the news that Jimmy Garoppolo tore his ACL on a scramble play pretty late on in the Kansas City game in Kansas City on Sunday. Obviously the Niners and the rivals in the division and stuff, but Shanahan's teams and Shanahan's offenses are a lot of fun to watch. I mean, you said a couple of years ago, you said last week that his team in Atlanta a couple of years ago is your favorite ever offense to watch. That's a devastating one. I mean, the team isn't that loaded. The calls going out from the Teddy Bridgewater's of the world, it's unnecessary because they're not going to do much anyway. They probably weren't going to do much with Garoppolo. They're not definitely going to do anything with Garoppolo, but it's still a devastating thing for Jimmy Garoppolo and that team, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel terrible for him, and we'll never be celebrating injuries on this podcast. That's one rule that we've sort of had from pretty early on, and I think it's terrible. And albeit a rival, he's a guy that I really enjoyed watching, and it's just not good for the league. It's not good for the division, and it's a shame because I was really actually looking forward to watching the Seahawks play against him in a few weeks' time. Because I thought it could have been a really good fun matchup to watch.
Yeah, because it was in a pretty meaningless game at the back end of last season as well, wasn't it? Because although he's only been there 2-3 weeks, he's now Shanahan's offense in San Francisco. Yeah, it would have been fun to see him against this form of the Seahawks defense.
He had one drive against us and scored a touchdown.
Yeah.
Because I think Brian Hoyer played the majority of the game and Garoppolo came in for the last drive of the game and scored a touchdown.
Hoyer was the rookie.
The CJ Bethardt.
Bethard. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's the one.
Yeah, also 49ers, after making a unbelievable play on a deep ball from Patrick Mahomes, the actual king of the NFL, Richard Sherman's calf has give up on him a little bit, and he's now out for a month. And according to someone on Twitter, it's an injury which is going to cost him around $4 million, with all the incentives that the Niners put on that team. I mean, I know people are going to say, look, this is why the Seahawks didn't pay him, but that play against Tyreek Hill, if that happens in however many weeks until we play them, I'll be very surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I would have paid him regardless, and I don't think you can say that a calf injury is something that you can necessarily predict or account for. I think a lot of that money is because he now is likely to miss out on things like All-Pro and whatever, which is not necessarily stuff that he was going to bank on, but obviously he's missing out on quite a few game incentives.
Yeah, I think it's game checks, game incentives. I think he had like thresholds for like
90% of playing time.
Yeah, snap counts and stuff. So I think that's what, $4.5 million. Jesus. Just because you got a tight calf or groin, whatever it was. And then also in the NFC West, the St. Louis Rams went out in the offseason and splashed all of the money on all of the defensive players. And two of them are Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib, who are now both out for the next month. And definitely with Talib, will miss the Seahawks-Rams game in 10 days or so, Adam. It's obviously probably not going to make much difference with how that offense looks to Sean McVay. But it's a positive, but also a bit of a blow for the Rams heading into a pretty big-time Thursday night game against the very angry Mike Zimmer and Minnesota Vikings, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, within the context of not celebrating injuries, F the Rams. And if it means that we've got, it now gives a puncher's chance against them in a game that I think is really going to dictate how the rest of the season goes. I still think Kirk Cousins is a pretty mediocre quarterback overall. So I think the Rams are going to have enough to get by the Vikings, whether it be because they score so many points. But it's certainly not helpful for their run, but at the minute they look like the best team in the NFL for me, which absolutely pains me to say it.
Yeah, they're on pace to have 3 1,000-yard receivers and obviously a 1,000-yard rusher in Todd Gurley. But I'm still not willing to admit that or accept, or will never accept, that Jared Goff is a good quarterback, and I can't wait to see the money they're going to give him in a couple of years. Do you agree?
Yeah, Mr. and that will ruin the whole thing, which is great.
Yeah.
So we just have to hope they don't win one before then.
Yeah, and I'm still not buying that they're in for Khalil Mack. That's just PR, so they get a few more people in the $6 seats at the Coliseum in LA. One other thing on NFL which come out this morning from Tom Pelissero, the NFL Network, Minnesota Vikings defensive end, Everson Griffin missed this week's game after what the team are describing as mental health issues, and he's now away from the team and apparently in hospital. There's all rumours of what happened at the team hotel with Hunter on Saturday night, but apparently he missed a lot of practice last week and he's going through some issues. All the best to him, because obviously we've seen with Tyler Linsky's of the world, mental health is something which doesn't get the attention and doesn't get the focus it probably deserves, and for someone at his level to be going through whatever he's going through is a bit concerning, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to invest in your mental health, I think, is quite a bit of sage advice for the future, as we go forward. And hopefully that's what he's done here, and he's able to nip it in the bud before it gets particularly devastating for himself or his family. Because that's the last thing anyone wants to see. So hopefully what he's been able to do is, stop this before it gets too bad for him and anyone around, and they can be, he can be okay.
Yeah. But yeah, with all that, I wholeheartedly agree. With all that considered, that Thursday night game should be quite something, even in the context of Thursday night games are usually terrible. And this week, Adam, we saw, probably Jimmy Haslam name Baker Mayfield the starting quarterback in Cleveland, because that was fun.
Yeah, he's just great to watch. There's nothing about him that looks like he should be that good, but he's just got whatever it is, he appears to have it, and I love watching him play, and I'm really looking forward to very weird world when you're looking forward to watching the Browns play on Sunday.
Yeah, it is very strange. Anything else you're looking forward to this week? You got any locks or shocks in the back pocket waiting to be unfurled?
I was just looking at the old locks and shocks. I think my lock of the week is going to be... Oh, it's Browns at Raiders. Bloody hell, that's a good one. I think my lock of the week is going to be the Chargers to beat the Niners.
Yeah, that's my killer pick this week.
Yeah, I think I may have to do that. And I think my shock of the week is going to be... Oh, you can't do it with the Dolphins, can you?
That's exactly what I'm looking at.
You can't. It can't.
I think it can. That offense does not look much cop. Chris Hogan, Cordarrelle Patterson, Phil Dorsett, even without Julian Edelman, has had two catches through 3 weeks. It's Gronkowski and James White or nothing.
Well, is Josh Gordon going to be back next week, maybe?
I don't know. He was inactive on Sunday, wasn't he?
Yeah. When's Edelman? Was it a 3 or 4 game ban that Edelman had?
4 game ban. He's still not fully back from his knee injury last year, apparently, either. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. We'll just, we don't have the same one. Let's be a little bit out of it. And let's go. I'm gonna have the Broncos going to get one over the Chiefs on Monday Night Football.
Okay.
At home.
I'm never going to go against Patrick Mahomes, I've got to be honest.
I'm not sure I'm going to go with it as a pick, but as a shock of the week, let's go with it.
Well, I do think the Dolphins might beat the Patriots. They are 3-0, and as you said, that team just seems like they're having a lot of fun, as we saw on the 15-yard line last week. I think some Lions and the Cowboys, because it's in Dallas maybe, but I think I'm going to go, and as my screen goes dark, I think the Giants might upset the Saints. Because that defense looks like it did for quite a long time, and obviously Drew Brees broke a couple of records over the weekend for passing yards.
I think it was completions.
Completions. And Michael Thomas is just on a ridiculous start to the season. He's been targeted 41 times through 3 games and has caught 38 of them. That is some pace to keep up for the rest of the season. But Saquon Barkley, Odell Beckham against that defense. Evan Ingram is out, which is a big bit of a blow to the Giants and my fantasy team. I think there's a long shot shock the Giants to win at home against the New Orleans Saints will properly set the cat amongst the pigeons in the NFC, and especially the NFC South.
Best division, the NFC South right now. It's just so fun. So much fun.
I mean, if I said to you, okay, there's going to be a quarterback who throws for 400 yards in the first three games of the season for the first time ever, how low down that list would Ryan Fitzpatrick have been?
Slightly under Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah, so it's not like the Andy Dalton threshold. It's literally the Colin Kaepernick bottom of the barrel. It's incredible. He's just, it is the air raid offense in Tampa Bay. And with DeSean Jackson, I think he said, showed a clip last night where he said it's the fastest receivers he's ever played with, and Chris Godwin and DeSean Jackson and Mike Evans, and even OJ Howard is stepping up as well. It is quite a potent offense. Wrapping up, we will be live in a few weeks in London. Some point during that week, we are still waiting for confirmation on all of the guests, or the few guests we're going to get in on the building. The Saturday night, obviously, Bay Party is sold out, and we do have a few guests announced, but we are waiting for the team's nod and approval to infill them. I'm pretty certain they are going to end up doing that. I think that's everything. Obviously, all the Hilinski Hope gear is in place, is in situ in my, it's right next to me, the biggest box the postman has probably ever delivered. That will be all available during the week and on the Saturday night, as well as an auction, all with the proceeds being split between Hilinski Hope, Archie Smile, and the SSAFA. C-Jax, as people have probably seen on Facebook, have now sold out this side of the Atlantic, and they've raised just over £3,000 in Ian Smith's name for the charities that Mal chose to, which best were the ones that he liked supporting. And that is pretty cool over the last two and a half years for all them to be sold and all that money to go towards that, because there was a hell of a lot when Ian suddenly passed away a few years ago. If you want to get involved, you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can on Facebook, the Pedestrian Podcast, the chapter group on Facebook. Well, the Facebook group is UK Seattle Seahawks fans, on Twitter at Seahawks UK, Instagram UK Seahawkers, personal at Twitter is at Stu underscore Court and at Adam D. Nathan. Again, a massive thanks to Jeff Perlman for joining us this week. Enjoy the game on Sunday, Adam.
Thank you. Enjoy the game yourself.
I will do. Hopefully I'll return in one piece with, hopefully not beat one after this weekend. Yeah, until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go home.
What does it feel physically? How does it feel after 32 carries?
I'll probably feel more of it tomorrow morning, so, you know, I'll probably want to let you know about that, but right now I feel pretty good.
Have you ever had 32 carries in a game?
I think the last time I had that was probably junior college or high school.
Welcome to another episode of the official and only, if only you... I'm doing the fucking mess. I can't remember what I say. I've done it like 70 times. I don't know what I say. Welcome to the first... Oh, my days. What is happening today? This is terrible. Right. Take four.
Someone's in holiday mode.
Yeah.